Welcome to the 37th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently ventured to Nashville, Tennessee for a State of the Science Summit on Breast Cancer. At this conference, we sat down with faculty from Sarah Cannon Research Institute, HCA Midwest Health, Virginia Cancer Specialists, and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center to discuss some of the practice-changing updates that have been occurring in the field. Since the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, clinicians have become familiar with pivotal data from several clinical trials that have the potential to impact their practice. For example, an updated biomarker analysis from the Phase 3 IMpassion 130 trial showed that progression-free and overall survival improvements with the combination of atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel in patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer or inoperable locally advanced TNBC are exclusive to patients with PD-L1 expression greater than or equal to 1% on immune cells. In March 2019, the FDA approved the PD-L1 inhibitor in combination with nab-paclitaxel for the treatment of patients with unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic PD-L1 positive TNBC. Additionally, results of the Phase 3 CATHERINE trial showed that adotrastuzumab emtansine could be a new standard of care for patients with HER2-positive disease with residual invasive disease after neoadjuvant therapy. T-DM1 reduced the risk of invasive disease recurrence or death by 50% versus trastuzumab, warranting a new adjuvant standard of care. First, we spoke with our chair of the meeting, Erica P. Hamilton, MD, who reflected on the most recent data reported in HER2-positive breast cancer and highlighted the additional therapies moving through the pipeline, which include the small molecule inhibitor tucatinib. In our interview, Hamilton, the director of the Breast and Gynecologic Research Program at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, covered how the encouraging data from CATHERINE could change the role of other agents improved for use in this setting.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. We certainly have some decisions to make for adjuvant HER2 therapy. I think the most important, it's really emphasized that we need to be giving HER2 patients neoadjuvant therapy. We used to really try to do that because that was the only setting that pertuzumab was approved. Now that we have pertuzumab approval in the adjuvant setting, I think some people got a little bit more lax about really trying to catch those patients before surgery. But I think that's really important to define who are going to be the good players and who are going to be the bad players and who needs additional therapy. There are some caveats. It really looks like, as far as neratinib, that it's probably the hormonally driven and HER2 driven patients that get the most benefit out of neratinib, not those that are hormone receptor negative and HER2 positive. For pertuzumab, there is a benefit, but the tough thing about that trial is the adjuvant pertuzumab study, patients didn't get neoadjuvant pertuzumab. So those that already received neoadjuvant pertuzumab, we can't really answer the question of is more pertuzumab better than already receiving it. I think the T-DM1 is very compelling because it very clearly defines a subset of patients that need therapy. It's those that received good neoadjuvant chemotherapy and didn't have that pathologic complete response that we're really looking for. If you look at that trial, about 70% of patients were ER positive, and that's largely, I think, because those are the patients that are probably less likely to have the pathologic complete response, because those that are hormone receptor negative are more likely to have a PCR than those who aren't. But again, a very high magnitude of benefit, about 11% in disease-free survival over a couple years there, so compelling.
Next, we sat down with Howard A. Skip Burris, MD, who provided a thorough overview of some additional exciting findings that came out of the 2018 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. Results of the earlier mentioned biomarker analysis from the IMpassion 130 trial also showed that other biomarkers, which included PD-L1 expression on tumor cells, intratumoral CD8 positive T cells, stromal tumoral infiltrating lymphocytes, and BRCA1 and 2 mutation status, also confirmed the importance of PD-L1 expression on immune cells in predicting clinical benefit derived from the atezolizumab combination. Looking ahead, Burris, who is the Chief Medical Officer of Sarah Cannon Research Institute and President-elect of ASCO, added that the breast cancer community should expect to focus on molecular profiling as well as upfront testing with PARP and CDK4/6 inhibitors.
So how to utilize next-generation sequencing or molecular profiling in your practice is a great debate. I've taken the position and have surveyed our community oncologists about what they would want for themselves or their loved ones, and almost uniformly, each of them, in the setting of having a relapsed or resistant tumor, would want to know the molecular profile if it was them or their loved one. That being said, I think how to handle the data, where it's applicable, remains a bit confusing. But I think this is a place where it might be the most important information we learn about the individual's tumor. My advocacy has been that for patients who have recurrent or relapse disease, that a next-generation sequencing approach should be part of their treatment decision-making. I think that you're doing it for the individual patient. You're doing it to increase the odds that they get in a clinical trial. You won't know until you search for those mutations. And then lastly, I think it's going to be what's needed for the field. I think that the more patients with resistant disease and recurrent disease that undergo molecular profiling, the better we'll understand where to utilize these drugs. While we don't know the answer yet around some specific prognostic factors, the MSI high or microsatellite stability or the high tumor mutational burdens, where those cuts are made remains of some debate, but that's okay. I think there's still a growing body of evidence that suggests the more mutations, the more unstable the tumor, the greater likelihood they're going to benefit with checkpoint therapy. And right now, for many of these patients, it might be participation in a trial, but it certainly helps point the patient toward the right clinical study.
In the realm of CDK4/6 inhibition, Nilima Dendalori, MD, explained that earlier diagnosis and more effective therapeutic options are enabling physicians to deliver higher rates of disease control and improved quality of life in patients with hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. Here from Dendalori, a medical oncologist with Virginia Cancer Specialists, who shared insight on the impact of CDK4/6 inhibitors and what is next for this class of agents in this space.
We've always had great targeted therapy in that we've had tamoxifen, fulvestrant, aromatase inhibitors, and other anti-estrogen agents to target the estrogen receptor. However, now we've made a lot of strides in stage 4 breast cancer where we use combination therapies with drugs called CDK4/6 inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors, and most recently another drug that will be added to the armamentarium is a PI3 kinase inhibitor called alpelisib. The CDK4 inhibitors have really transformed how we treat ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer in the metastatic setting. They've delayed the time to chemotherapy by double the amount as in the past. These drugs that are ribociclib, abemaciclib, and palbociclib are oral drugs that enhance the efficacy of the current anti-estrogen therapies we have. What's very interesting is no matter how extensive the person's disease is, how young or old they are, whether they're pre- or postmenopausal, these drugs seem to really improve their outcomes when added to anti-estrogen therapy. Additionally, we're doing more molecular profiling of tumors, and what we see in up to 40% of breast cancers is a PI3 kinase C mutation. And this has allowed us to target in the way of a drug called alpelisib, which is an alpha-specific PI3 kinase inhibitor. And when added to a standard endocrine backbone of fulvestrant, it has improved progression-free survival. Side effects include stomatitis and increased blood sugar fatigue. However, we as a breast cancer community will learn how to manage those side effects and really improve the outcomes of these women. So we know that the CDK4 inhibitors have transformed the advanced breast cancer setting. I think that we have some great trials looking at these agents in the early breast cancer setting, and these trials are either completing accrual or have completed accrual, and so hopefully we'll be able to improve outcomes in these women or men in early breast cancer. Additionally, the other improvement I think that we are is learning how to manage the toxicities, because these drugs are associated with toxicities such as the blood counts dropping, also fatigue, liver functions increasing. The other thing with these drugs that I think we're going to get really much better at is managing the toxicity, whether it's liver function abnormalities, blood counts dropping, or something called a QTC interval that's prolonged, or the diarrhea. Now we've learned to recognize them, and I think providers are no longer scared of the toxicities, and patients are no longer scared because we're better educating them. So therefore, we really can deliver the right drug to the right person at the right time and truly improve their quality of life while controlling their disease.
Next, we spoke with Stephanie L. Graff, MD, who is the director of the breast program at the Sarah Cannon Research Institute at HCA Midwest Health and associate director of the breast cancer program at Sarah Cannon Research Institute. Recently, studies have shown that escalation and de-escalation approaches are moving to the forefront with chemotherapy, endocrine therapy, and CDK4/6 inhibitors in patients with HR-positive disease. For example, results from the Phase 3 TAM-01 trial show that the addition of low-dose tamoxifen significantly reduced the risk of new and recurrent disease after surgery in patients with atypical ductal carcinoma, lobular carcinoma in situ, and estrogen receptor positive or ductal carcinoma in situ of unknown origin. In our interview, Graff reviewed these evolving changes in therapy.
I'm going to be sharing a little bit in the way of updates on opportunities to both escalate and de-escalate care for hormone receptor positive breast cancer. Of course, on the heels of the TAILOR-X trial, which we saw at ASCO this year, 2018, we saw that a lot of women won't need chemotherapy to treat their breast cancer, which I think is a huge opportunity for us to de-escalate care. But that's also going on in the background of lots of discussion around what the right length of adjuvant endocrine therapy is. Should we take endocrine therapy for 5 years? Should we take endocrine therapy for 2 years? Does it matter if it's 10 years of an aromatase inhibitor or 5 years of tamoxifen followed by 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor? And so there's a lot of really interesting thought happening. And then there's some emerging clinical trials starting to look at the CDK4/6 inhibitors adjuvantly for patients with locally advanced hormone receptor positive breast cancer, moving those drugs out of the metastatic setting into the early stage setting. And I think that there's just a lot of really interesting opportunities around the issue of escalation and de-escalation of care. So one of the things that really interested me at San Antonio in 2018 was that we saw data looking at using tamoxifen for women with ductal carcinoma in situ or the high-risk precancerous lesions like lobular carcinoma in situ or atypical ductal hyperplasia. And it asked the question of tamoxifen at 5 milligrams versus no therapy. And again, so this was almost in a prevention sort of setting. It's DCIS patients, it's atypical ductal hyperplasia patients. The standard dose of tamoxifen has been 20 milligrams, but we know, of course, that that comes with a lot of side effects, including kind of scary side effects like thromboembolic disease and uterine carcinoma. And so looking at this 5 milligram dose, we saw a big benefit compared to nothing. And I think it gives us, again, an opportunity to kind of de-escalate where something is better than nothing. And so those patients with stage zero ductal carcinoma in situ that maybe are worried about side effects or are poorly tolerant, this gives us a real opportunity to still offer something.
There have been encouraging data with the alpha-specific PI3K inhibitor alpelisib in patients with PIK3CA mutant breast cancer, which are leading to the use of more targeted approaches in breast cancer, said Denise A. Yardley, MD, senior investigator, breast cancer research program at Sarah Cannon Research Institute. Findings from the SOLAR-1 trial highlighted the anti-tumor activity with the agent. It also demonstrated an improvement in progression-free survival in this patient population compared with those who received fulvestrant plus placebo. Yardley further discussed the impact of these data in our interview.
I think looking at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Conference, it continues to build on a changing standard of practice for patients that are facing a diagnosis of breast cancer. And so what we're continuing, I think, to see as a big message is just really trying to refine our treatment recommendations. And so for early stage patients, it's really trying to decide on which patients needed chemotherapy, which patients can avoid chemotherapy, and then for those patients that are going to benefit from endocrine therapy, the extended endocrine therapy. And so we're really seeing not the one-size-fits-all anymore. It's really tailoring it on a case-by-case basis. So I know in my own practice, my discussions become longer and longer, trying to assimilate the data and bring the patients into that patient-physician partnership in trying to make these treatment decisions. I think in the metastatic setting, we see the ability also to try to refine our treatments. And so as we see more and more trials with niche populations in the metastatic breast cancer setting, we are learning that genomic profiling of breast cancer tumors are extremely important in the metastatic setting, even in the first line setting, even for the hormone positive patients. We had updates on the SOLAR-1 data that was initially presented at ESMO and looking at the importance of PI3 kinase mutations. And even though that was involved in the PI3 AKT mTOR pathway with everolimus and the Bolero-2, now we have that SOLAR-1 data that shows that, yes, there's benefit from these targeted agents, and this is a reason to profile to identify patients with the PI3 kinase mutations. We see that exciting data with now immunotherapy for the first time. Do we see that enter the realm of breast cancer with really a strong signal? And, you know, I've had partners in our practice at Sarah Cannon that have a longstanding history already and lung cancer with immunotherapy, but now breast cancer actually rocks with immunotherapy, and that's confined to triple negative breast cancer patients in the first line setting, and on top of that it's those that are PD-L1 positive. And so we are really learning to tailor our treatment recommendations for different subtypes, the presence of different mutations in the breast cancer, and really making those treatment decisions that are really hinging on having that data available.
Finally, we sat down with Komal Jhaveri, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, who highlighted the evolving landscape of triple-negative breast cancer, the emergence of checkpoint inhibition, PARP inhibitors, and antibody drug conjugates have helped change the outlook for patients with metastatic disease. Overall, according to Jhaveri, the next steps to take in TNBC treatment include determining better predictive markers of benefit, exploring combinations with PARP inhibitors, and conducting larger trials of ADCs.
So certainly, at least we have 2018 giving us two approvals for our PARP inhibitors, olaparib and talazoparib, based on the phase 3 trials, namely the Olympiad and the EMBRACA trials, both of which showed consistently a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival of about 3 months, favoring the PARP inhibitor compared to a physician choice chemotherapy. Now, these trials were seen in platinum-sensitive patients, so patients were either, you know, allowed to have a platinum in the metastatic setting, but were not allowed to progress in that setting to be eligible, or if they had received platinum in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting, the treatment-free interval had to be more than 12 months. So I think we do need to see a head-to-head trial, like we have the TNT trial that evaluated the role of carboplatin and showed doubling of response rate in a germline BRCA mutant patient compared to docetaxel. What we don't really have at this point currently is a head-to-head trial of a platinum with a PARP inhibitor. And I think our focus right now has also been to understand resistance mechanisms to PARP inhibitors. One thing that we are trying to understand better is that by accumulation of the DNA damage, which is occurring due to the PARP inhibition, there might be upregulation of PD-L1 activity. There might be stimulation of the STING pathway, which has led to multiple trials evaluating combinations of PARP inhibitors with immune therapy, specifically checkpoint blockade. So we have the Mediola trial that is looking at durvalumab and olaparib. We have the Topazio trial that was presented at ASCO that looked at niraparib with pembrolizumab. We have an ongoing Javelin trial looking at avelumab with talazoparib. So I think early data from these trials are suggesting that perhaps there might be an increased durability and potentially an improved progression-free survival with the combination. The response rates remain identical to what we've seen with monotherapy. So I guess we need more data, we need more understanding, and better biomarkers to better understand this.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 37th episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to review the latest data in neuroendocrine tumors, register for our meeting on April 20th in Lexington, Kentucky. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on genitourinary cancers on April 24th in Boston, Massachusetts. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.